proposal that I'm trying to do, and I'll leave this with you, and I believe it's going to be introduced, will be an amendment to Democrats allow the public defender to enter into the matter that we're talking about here. My understanding is that, and the support I wish to offer, and not speak directly to 279, because I'm not so informed on the bill, but if the decision is made to move in this direction, I would hope that some consideration be given to the fact that if these cases are in fact to be tried, and if there's no immediate presence, increase in habeas corpus decisions in Marion County, that some consideration fiscally be given to the side of Marion County and the citizens of Marion County, who, although they do not pay for the judge's salary, do pay for most of the supporting services in the court system. The result is that anything to be done to spread the jail around would be most appreciated. And that's the only extent of my comment.
Thank you.
these amendments, as proposed, will be adopted by the committee and replace the present pending legislation regarding this subject. And we would leave the fields of disagreement to be worked out by this committee as they see fit. In the proposed amendment, with respect to number one, at the very least, in informing the person that he can bring his own attorney to both the preliminary hearing and the final revocation hearing. And then number two, the purposes only of the revocation hearing, that's the final determination, that he would be provided appointed counsel. Now, there was a question that the Solicitor General at a previous hearing suggested it might be fairly difficult for the full board to appoint an attorney. And I would suggest that this could be cured by simply having the full board apply to the circuit court to ask the circuit court to appoint an attorney for the indigent employee. I don't think it would radically be any problem.
With regard to the matter of contract, the board does not take up the issue for agent contract. We feel that the state agent, the undetermined fiscal implications that we cannot take the issue on the matter of the state agent contract. By asking us to operate the procedure, we'd be allowing the same counsel at the expense of the fellow or alleged fellow violator at any stage of the proceedings.
Thank you. Because you don't mean to me your point view of the perfect group of people without my son. In other words, our son is being raised from here, and it's the only way to go. Now, this is a health opportunity. You think this guy's got a fair deal of value to discuss?
It's difficult to say. We're in the process of litigating some of these issues that are not clear as a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision. I believe that the Fourth Amendment that follows would be very much acceptable. But the only remaining problem is whether or not the parolee can effectively prepare any kind of a case on his own. Otherwise, the procedures in this court, in these amendments, I believe, would be very adequate.
Yeah,
I would be very thankful.
Well, I just want to see this maybe on the right side. As I view a situation like this, you come out from 1977 and look to the court. You seem to be an adversary position and you try to do what's right. And I the business, poor boy, is trying to figure out what's best for that man and helping him to know how to raise questions, to take a way to help the investigators, what the heck is the matter. Do you think you'll do that? I don't know if I will.
Within the existing resources, I think it's a virtual impossibility, however, for the parole board to adequately look into and explore all possible things that could be explored with regard to whether or not that parolee should be recommitted.
How can they? They got time.
They don't. Well, it's my understanding they have a difficult enough time just trying to process things. Perhaps Mr. Johnson could comment on that.
The board, but they don't have enough resources to do the job that they're doing.
Okay, the first thing. The second thing, then, is that I believe that the parole board, like any agency, is generally acting in good faith. But I think it's just like in any other kind of a proceeding, before an administrator or before a judicial officer, that it really develops into it. I think it should be considered an adversary proceeding because we're talking about reincarceration. And I just think that perhaps sometime, regardless of good faith, that expediency may on occasion take precedence over maybe the best interest of society and a particular parolee. And I'm not suggesting any bad faith in any way.
And he's done that. Now, maybe I'm thinking maybe it's too much to do with it, but the idea of the whole question is different. But if I haven't done it, I think I'm telling you this, and I find it style of power, and I'm not just revenge. They said it's not for revenge, but this thing came out of me instead. I'm trying to. If you go here, I think you've got to have a lot more lawyers working on this. I don't know if you really don't have potential staff to reinforce the poor boy, to really delve into this guy's power and try to have an adversary, where you really, you put the staff that he's got to stand his own. So that's the lucky, lucky guy. What do you do with the case? You know,
that may be, Senator. The problem is that, at least under the constitutional law and the country today, it is indeed an adversary proceeding as identified by the United States Supreme Court in unanimous decision. And I can only say that regardless, that maybe that would be a nice approach to try with regard to expanding the staff. I think they're still part of one side of the picture, whereas the parolee is really on the other side because he's going to be reincarcerated. And perhaps only an independent resource, not tied to the parole board, not tied to corruption, can truly advocate his position. Even if counsel is provided in all of these cases, the parole board still has a tremendous amount of discretion with regard to how to dispose of that case. And it seems to me that, incidentally, by, I don't know if this makes any difference, the kind of standing that the Health Judiciary Committee has adopted an amendment, I think, to 2050 that would provide appointed counsel for parole and juvenile situations. Someone mentioned that to me yesterday, and for what that's worth.
Are there any cases that that would change the outcome of a pending case?
No.
You know, no appeals now on the basis of the opinion of the chair board and the questions of procedures that are not
okay.
Before any court would be affected by this one.
But particular cases would not be affected by this legislation. They would be decided on constitutional law. Yeah, not obviously the a new court is giving itself a pending case, at least many of the ones that are pending now. But there are indeed, at least there's at least one case pending, not on the counter issue, but on another thing that I raise in a moment, that will eventually be decided on constitutional law. And if these amendments were adopted and this bill were made law, at least one of the things in that future litigation would not even be raised at this point, given that. Because there are those who issue, there's a couple of issues left there that are not pending. Some of the heard, I'd like to stress that one statement I made, that there are not 50 more impact statements. 30 people will receive reference in the study state. They have no connection to any state contact or supervision, or the state of Oregon for supervision. 19 are presently in out-of-state institutions under other sentences. 6 are illegal out-of-state jails, meaning local with regard to the matter of Mr. Cable's statement regarding 2050, the House Judiciary Committee did pass out 2050 with amendment related to juvenile parole violators in the matter of conflict. They did attach the amendment of which when the person was violation, they allowed the same conflict. That committee was the same committee to pass out House Bill 2110. And at that time, they had considered the right to counsel matters in the case of adult parole violators. They apparently had made a distinction based on youth and immaturity, and that is the basis for the difference of the two bills that they came out of that committee, as I understand it. And this is back to committee on that.
Recall any case where there has been a full revocation and where subsequently you had, aside from on technical grounds, somebody trying to leave it from this, really where you felt an injustice was done and where you have gone on to reverse your prior revocation.
Well, the procedure under the law before Morrison, this common party was a little different. There have been cases where once you became aware of the operative facts surrounding the alleged parole violator, even though he may have been in violation, that we found that due to changing circumstances or the circumstances of their existence and the order was issued, they were undetectable. We had reversed our position and reinstated them on the trial. I could not give you a number, but
no, I don't care about it. In other words, though, you can't rectify an injustice if one has some place to say there's a real injustice, not based on mere technicality.
Yes, Senator, that's correct.
Section 16 of the proposed amendment. That section provides that if an alleged parole violator is in custody in a state to which he has not been paroled, usually in that situation, decision. Then he is not entitled to a preliminary hearing, the preliminary hearing that has been required by the United States Supreme Court. And also, in that kind of a situation, if he contests, if he wishes to contest the matter, and he gets to the final revocation hearing, there can be statements adverse to him that where he will not be allowed to confront those accusers. And that would be a situation where a person out of state has something to say that's negative or adverse to him, and that can be used against him, and he'll never have an opportunity to confront that person. I don't believe this section will withstand constitutional rights in the case, and that's one of the issues that is now being litigated. If this section were adopted, then in effect that would mean that a parolee who's been accused of violation of parole would probably never ever have an opportunity to confront any person or the main person who are accusing him. Would never have an opportunity to confront those persons. The United States Supreme Court says that confrontation is to be afforded with regard to adverse witnesses. And it's a difficult problem, I realize that. However, I think the board should effectively comply with the Supreme Court decision without this question. It's my understanding that if a parolee is out of state, and if he's allegedly violated conditions of parole, that eventually the corrections division employee or someone from the state of Oregon will go to that state to secure custody. And I see no reason why that agent of Oregon cannot hold the preliminary hearing that is required by the United States Supreme Court. So I don't think that this question is necessary, and I don't think it'll withstand what happened in the court.
The intention by Section 16 of the Bank is to limit the minority opinion.
Is
to limit the minority opinion. And it does a general statement relating to operation of the people on parole violation proceedings. There is no one at this time having reference to the Office of the Attorney General. But human rights over America contemplate that these interstate exchanges. We have a particular problem here, and the one of the purposes is to limit the matter and take the on-site parole violation proceedings out. Because in these situations, unbecular officials have responded to either Oregon, the supervising state, or has responded from an interstate contact state responsible for supervising, and ends up in Timbuktu problem. Under that situation, the state where he is found to arrest and change him, usually for another reason, has no obligation, legally or otherwise, to respond to request by Oregon that non-site hearing. And no state that I'm aware of has expressed a willingness to do that. As an analogy, even in the interstate contact state, where they're supervising the person directly detained in that state, they hold him and we request to him to have problems with that. To date, there have been two states who are not even responding to the interstate contact agreement to conduct on-site hearings. One is the state of Washington. We made two requests there. For some policy consideration, unknown to Oregon, they would not conduct it. We're now advised that the law says they will conduct in San Francisco, holding for supervising. One of those cases is presently pending in the Maryland Circuit Court. And it's under advisement, I believe. The state of California has refused to conduct non-time hearings for the man who is under arrest for detention on new crime related to the state of California. And then his probation or parole has been revoked and has been committed either to a local or an institution in that state. And the first way you can correspond is in the past by Mr. Burns. So we made a request for non-time hearings 2 or 3 months ago. And they told the police officer that Bob did not respond to Bonnie's call. Because their attorney general has advised them that in the state of California, the man is not due a federal violation hearing of that nature. So that's where these are some of the difficulties we get into. That's why we're trying to limit the effect. It would limit the effect in part to not of deleting the right to confrontation. The purpose is to indicate that when the organ is conducting the second stage part of this proceeding, here, that organ does not have the responsibility to produce the out-of-state witness in the state of Oregon to testify to suggestion to confrontation and cross-examination. There's a question whether we can do that, and secondly, if we could do it, there's a question of the cost involved. In any event, if we could do it and we were financed to do it, you're getting to both an official and unofficial claim without a state. Under some state operating procedures, they will not allow their authority to go out of state and come into another state for the purposes of giving evidence of being cross examined. That's the problem that's in front of you, as we have not yet determined how to get around that problem. We think eventually this matter will be litigated and will be determined judicially. We have this in the bill because, number one, we do not know if we have the power to promulgate rules that plead these particular type cases that are very difficult without address within the legislature. Number two, to be quite candid about it, even with the section in here, we do not know whether or not it is constitutional. We do know this matter will be eventually determined in court. That is done by board operating rules and regulations under the Enabling Act or under the section that's proposed in here. But that is the reason for the section. We think it is a firm, reasonable reason to have this section in here. Well, the deputy contact administrator would assign a call officer in this case to go put the man in.
Is it a call officer?
I'm not sure whether it is or is a call officer.
Is there a call officer in the state of California? Is there a call officer in the state of California?
May I ask one question? I believe Mr. Dodd is a director of the field services here. I could ask if he could respond to that.
In most cases, the exception of the business call officer is Dr. Zola. We do use sheriff's institutions and police departments around the state. Typically, we do about 90% of the state. Can we find the sheriff's office in the country? Also, we just this call for the first probation violator about a state that's done by the county. So we just do the
probation
violator. So the probation violator about the state violator.
All right, thank
you. The first objection I would have is a serious one. I guess in the original 379, the full board would have been covered by the Administrative Procedures Act, both with regard to really making unprotected cases and judicial review, and that we now have proposed amendments provide for the ACA application only with regard to rulemaking, and we would agree that this is perfectly acceptable. On the matter of judicial review, under the ACA, it would have been judicial review of a replication order to the Court of Appeals on the record. At that time the Chair Board opposed that. We've now done a complete reversal. I would suggest that judicial review of parole revocation remain in the circuit court where it is now for two reasons. At least one reason. One is, as Senator Carson has already indicated, there are lawyers now being made available to people who have heard this type of decision in Marion County. There's no reason to believe at this time that the Court of Appeals will also make lawyers available. This is going to become a very complicated and confusing thing. If you have a number of people who have had their parole revoked, who are on their own, not only initially, filing their petitions for judicial review, but they're also going to have to finish it out themselves because I don't think lawyers are going to be made available. I would suggest, however, that I'm talking about judicial review, and in Marion County, here this purpose, the courts and the bar are making those available. Whereas I don't think that will happen with the case of the Court of Appeals. I would suggest that if judicial review remains under habeas corpus in the circuit court, that one of the main problems can be cured by having it heard on the record. In other words, at the closing time, the Chair Board members and various sessions say you have to go over and spend time at the courthouse on habeas corpus cases. But with the procedures that would be administrative procedures that would be legislatively adopted, I believe that those procedures are adequate such that there can be a full and fair and adequate judicial review on the record without requiring the full board of corrections employees to spend a lot of time in court. And I think the other problem was in my previous testimony, I really didn't know whether if there was judicial review in the Court of Appeals, whether an inmate could still subsequently file a writ of habeas corpus, which would simply compound all of the judicial proceedings. And I'm probably saying the other way, he probably can still file a writ of habeas corpus, particularly because under these proposed amendments, he would have to seek judicial review in the Court of Appeals within 60 days. Now, if he doesn't have an attorney, or for any number of reasons, he didn't know how to do it within 60 days, or even if he did file it in 60 days, he's probably, there's still a chance he's going to file it in habeas corpus. So it seems to me at this time that it might be wise, number one, to simply not make any reference to judicial review and leave it as it is, simply habeas corpus in the circuit court, or number two, leave it under habeas corpus, but allow it to be on the record without having all of the parties having to be present.
The board seems to place this judicial review provision primarily for the following reasons. The board feels it is great for the Court of Appeals to achieve uniformity and consistency and continuity with regard to the decision handed down related to federal law. We also feel that the Court of Appeals would give better direction and guidelines relating to federal law because their decisions are public. And therefore, we would have an indication of how they are looking at the situation as it develops. The Attorney General's office has advised us to take this course of action because they compromised Senate Bill 467, which is an ACA-related bill to corruption and has a similar judicial review provision in it. They would like this course of action because corruption is unparalleled, although they may operate somewhat differently, are not altogether different when we deal with the same person and we're in the same general area. They feel they could get a better pattern of consistency between how to advise both the Texas division and the Board of Trial. As Mr. Kegel indicated, this would reduce and cut down the time needed. Part of the board members or all of the board members are required to prepare and go into court and testify personally. Those take
Thank you.
question too. What I'd like to know now, and so I'd like to ask about this too late, is that your opinion is the same primarily with cosmetics, and that's generally quite return. Now, how very interesting is still bad that being hard is enough to do right now. And we don't need to tell you that. What I'm trying to say now is, it looks like we took out a pretty big job here at the start of the time, and then the only other commitment to leadership is on the side to say the talk about this thing. See how good it is? And how much do you wrap this up to a little bit of work that's going to happen?
Thank you.
think that the presentation would be most effective if we had Mr. Heath and Professor Bailey to put the two together, and I think that would expedite it. Would that be all right? I think
Thank you.
Republicans for residents themselves have been drafted on the basis of the so-called Uniform Commercial Sales Act, which was enacted back east in about 12 states. And could have had very little attention. As far as I know, there have been no real judicial problems arising after the time the code was enacted. So this fifth supervision was as soon as certain attorneys involved in real estate lending look into this thing, and for one example, they realized that it was a very possible problem. And the result was that they suggested a re-looking of this whole area. And well, it would be the amendment to this provision, as it now stands, and it has been enacted in Oregon, but it doesn't stand in Oregon, basically means that if, let us say, I was a homeowner, buy a fence, I bought a new fence, I buy it on time, and I make it security to the person who sells the fence. I have a mortgage on a real estate. The person who sold me the furnace does not possess, as we call it, the security interest by filing on the Article 9. He does not file. He just merely sells me the furnace, takes my agreement stating that the furnace is security, and he has the right to take the furnace back out of my house if I don't pay the installment that goes on here. And there's a mortgage on the real estate. This mortgage is given an inferior position to this professor mortgagee who may have sold his mortgage a long time ago, which would include anything that any that's only attached to the real estate, has an inferior position under this provision of an outstanding to the secured party, who sells you the funds on time. And as this was looked at, it was felt that this had gone to. Yes, it might be all right to say that if a furnace seller wants to add some value to the property, sell a furnace, wants to possess, that can be done on the Article 9. And he may go ahead and do so, and he can have priority over the real estate owners. He's adding something to their property. But to go on and say that the furnace secured party can just merely sell the furnace on time and do nothing more, and can get a priority as to that furnace over mortgage interest. That's been a little bit too far. At least that was the thought of many people involved in real estate transactions. Then another type of problem that could arise might involve a builder who thinks that there's a builder, and now I'm a builder, and I've got a I'm building, I have 20 lots, and I'm building 10 lots. I go to the West Bank and get a construction loan for my building operation. I then go to the Rice Furnace Company and buy 20 furnaces for these 10 houses. I buy these furnaces on time, on sale. I then go, in getting my construction loan, I go to the bank and say, please lend me the money. Your obligator is lend me the money for my construction. I see from the bank that I have to make a private payment. Go ahead and lend me the money for these payments.
Thank you.
Your thing is to very well go the same way as the swimming pool, if the lender on the finance does not, if they sell on the finance, it's not extend until the finance is installed, they don't have the mortgage, the mortgage is like that, under the present code. Under the new code, if the lender on the finance files within 10 days of its installation in the house, thank you. with somebody who is financing the transaction. And I'll be in the same position as if, instead of being in a laying land gas where you're an auto dealer, I've got a car from you, and I took the car through and say, as a person who's making you the dealer, the loan on the car. It's actually just the very same thing. There are some other provisions which are intended to require that a person who finances oil and gas operations and mineral operations first acquire in much the same manner as a mortgagee would have to file. So the title company's other searching land powers would be able to locate this financing in looking at land records. Yes, yes, I think it would.
And we would spend an oil and all leases would now be under the financing.
Well, it would still be filed. It would still be filed in a land sense. But as a lease itself, it would have to be recorded in on the land record. And I don't know too much about that business. The lease would be recorded in land record, and if the leasing party himself borrowed in order to finance the extraction of the oil, taking out the oil, that would be filed in the same place as the lease.
Okay, page 7, we've got a fourth clue right now.
Yeah.
24, line 21, of Brown. Proposition is still in. And that was a non-uniform amendment that was drafted and enacted by the legislature. I think it was 1967, I remember. Somebody got hold of me over at the law school at the time this was being drafted in Nashville. It was intended to provide as this new, as this definition of transgender utility and provision dealing with it, that you're a utility, a power company, an oil pipe company, a gas pipe company, somebody has been in a business of that sort. He operates in a number of companies. He puts in what is a telegraph pole. High tension, showing high tension wires. High tension made right across the mountain. And he buys the equipment. If they are treated as regular fixtures, it would mean that there would have to be filings in the county office describing the real estate in detail. It's putting in a meets and bounds description of every piece of real estate on which there's actually a telegraph pole. This is intended actually to, the other provisions on transgender utilities, to get filings centrally with the Secretary of State. We don't have to go through the problems of filing if you might know that with an ordinary picture. Incidentally, Senator, I believe probably half the state has made non-uniform amendments to Article 9, similar to the one that I was mentioned last year in 79-2020, subsection 5. Page 24, line 21, down to the bottom of the page. This is actually a restructuring of 79-2030 and 79-2040 together. I don't think it makes any substantive changes, but it does clarify the situation a little bit. There have been a problem in the old 79-2040, which this is related. We're up on page 20, line 5-9. A security agreement in which the non-attack initial is agreement. Well, last year in old 79-2030, it stated there had to be a written agreement or the collateral in possession. There was an inconsistency of language there. I'm pretty certain it meant written agreement. And as far as I can recall, the text was so stated. There had to be, a written agreement or basically, these provisions are merely clarification and restructuring. This actually does not make any basic change. It merely provides or permits a security, a party to agree that all of the debtors collateral hereafter held may be covered within the financial. This normally is applied to in the cell financial. I finance your store, I finance the store that you operate. I want to cover all inventory if you acquire, not just what you have on hand now, but everything you get in the future. There's a continued source of financing going on. It's more or less primitive by capitalist profit.
You say that was in existence
now? It was understood from the old section 7904 subsection 4. Because it says, no, it doesn't affect under an amplified copy plan, it's not the contingent under certain circumstances, which inferentially means it will affect to anything else. Again, we have to look at something else. Page 29, line 136, which is about the other 1 6. Let me just find an ordinary place business. We talked about it already, Sunday, in connection with what we're buying for a well. And I suggested that we're not really dissimilar from by buying gas from your gas well. We're not dissimilar in my connection with my rights to my buying a car from you if you're a car dealer. I take full care of your security anyway. Now, in the case of a farmer or a rancher, this is not so. The second line of 7907 has this exception. A farmer who gives us a large amount of stock cannot sell them free of the security interest to a buyer, or they know about it. Buys the stock, they do not take free of the security interest. And this exception is in here, and it's based on some old case law, and rather thoroughly analyzed in one of the two of the best written treatment. It was decided in, going back to your question now, in 7904, subsection 2, line 26 and 27, it was decided that since a buyer of farm products, even an ordinary course of business, did not take free of the protection of the ordinary security interest, he ought at least to take free of a then protected security interest. In other words, if a bank has a loan to a farmer, a stock loan to a farmer, and does not clear the file on the top, and I buy them, I just take free and clear. I buy the farmer's gain. But if, on the other hand, the bank makes the stock loan and files, then my taking would be subject to the security. I buy the stock.
You're selling it?
Yes. In fact, in my classes, I say, run and gas file, and keep on filing, and file.
It's good looking at the
file. I don't know. Page 22, you've eliminated the language regarding security interest. It's not more than $25. I don't know. The file makes that one. Yes, that is a limit. We have a provision here saying in effect that a farmer who bought, let us say, a used tractor, a small tractor costing $2,500 or less, he could get a security interest which was automatically protected when taken. There was no necessity of farming. It is, I think, said that a small farm equipment purchase that said, was similar to a consumer goods purchase, and it was not really good to call up the farm. As time has gone on, it's been found that some lenders are reluctant to lend to farmers. When farmers may have a lot of small farm machinery or used equipment, something of that sort, in their possession, the lenders reluctant to lend and take a security interest in these type of equipment because there's no way they can set up and maybe there's a loan that's protected with the structure because farming is not permitted able to buy a bike on a tractor, and it cost under $2,500. And the first lender had not filed, the second lender did file, the first lender prevailed because he, as we said, it was protected, so even though he did not file. That was a decision of ours. And it caused some ripples in the legal lending. I'm going to get into half questions of this
class.
I want to still clarify what I thought you said earlier. By and large, there are two types of changes here. One type of amendment are amendments that the original law when it's first approved was adopted and they're not included. The law of third line is not included in the 79406, subsection 3. Which is believed in the only new version, can leave many people equally upset. So it is basically a rule of thumb provision to determine what constitutes what we call proceeds of fraud, whether he better sells fraud and he gets money. Well, that's easy. If he gets money, when he puts the money in an envelope and he says, this is the proceeds of my sale of the so and so, that makes it easy. But there will be tariffs on the money. There will be bank accounts. There will be various other things that come in. And this is intended to put in, to set forth a rule of thumb between who's saying what is and what is not proceeds, then the debtor becomes insolvent. And you have to, you can't trace everything. You can, so it starts off, however, with talking about cash and bank accounts. It mentions bank accounts. And that's why we want the definition of deposit accounts. They put it in back here on page 15 because they do have here the deposit account on page 27. But a deposit account that contains only proceeds. A cash borrower account maintained with a lending bank, for example, would be proceeds.
Assigning them numbers, assigning our staff to go into Portland, for example, and from there direct.
and thereby would bypass the big prison, so we thought that he was going to push it to Quimby. When testifying before the House, we pointed out that originally the cutoff, we had in mind a very informal kind of a process that we, in dialoguing with the parole board, that we thought that an amendment could be applied. And this was addressed to the Senate committee. After line 19 on the bill, we would insert the corrections provision may have for rehabilitative purposes in a workplace facility or parolee under the jurisdiction of the State Board of Parole and Probation with a written consent of the parolee and the approval of the board in accordance with procedures established by the division and the board. In other words, we have dialogue together and we have agreed that this would satisfy both of us, and we so recommend.
Well, Chairman, this amendment really clarifies what we have to do.
It clarifies it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Under this, before you can take a PLE and put them in a resolution, you can go into a resource or something like that, you can't get a deal.
He would be what he was getting for next. He would be faster than five. The alternative would be putting him in jail. And if for me, if I were a man like that, this choice wouldn't be hard to make.
I'd give him a deal to get to the man.
This is right. A man could call up, you see, from a tavern and say, come and get me. He's on a path and he knows he's gone. We know that there's a family crisis. And he would ask for alcohol or some other thing. We would say to him, we all know that, you know, that this can't continue. And the better course is for us to get together in some kind of a neutral setting for a few hours or a day or two until this cool is off. Perhaps we'll run around kind of starting to become drug related type. Personal kind of being drug related style. We are now, if this channel would say they can truly assess it, we could kind of put them right back into their own situation. If they refuse to follow our counsel and justice, sometimes we have to be more justice. Now, the court can make a condition if they're not a particular person. Most of the judges do follow our conditions and put them on a set of probation under the supervision of the section of agent's conditions. Which we feel are quite flexible. The government adopts these conditions to an individual basis, not just shotgun. Now, in this case here, the judges, many of them, put them under the section of agent and do not follow up with a specific condition, especially in a drug related type case with two people are involved in the same time with the city associates. So, in closing here, we do oppose the right of city associates. We do feel it's flexible enough at this point where most of them can associate, but we do feel the probation officer should be able, at a given point on a Sunday night, be able to interfere in the case and say no association. Thank you.
Thank you.